You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. That was legendary Grammy-winning drummer John Densmore backing up Jim Morrison on The Doors' classic Roadhouse Blues. In his more than 50 years in music, John Densmore has played with and gotten to know some of the greatest musicians of our time, from Janis Joplin and Paul Simon to Ravi Shankar and Willie Nelson, as well as some inspiring non-musicians from the Dalai Lama to screenwriter Joseph Campbell. He's managed to learn something from many of those interactions, lessons he writes about in his new book, The Seekers, Meetings with Remarkable Musicians and Other Artists. And today, John Densmore joins me on the podcast to discuss the many musical influences on The Doors, what he thought the first time he met Jim Morrison, and how Morrison's tragic self-destruction served as a cautionary tale that kept John Densmore straight the rest of his life. We talk about Oliver Stone's movie, The Doors, the tense legal battle between John and his bandmates over the commercial use of The Doors' songs, and how he made peace with The Doors' Ray Manzarek just before his death in 2013. John goes into the importance of space and silence in music, the power of improvisation to take him to a higher place, and the person whose drumming style he most emulates to this day. Plus his friendship with classical conductor Gustavo Dudamel, jamming with rock and roll wild man Jerry Lee Lewis, and smoking weed with Willie. Coming up with drummer John Densmore in just a moment. John Densmore is an original and founding member of The Doors. In 1993, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and since then, he has earned a Grammy Award for Lifetime Achievement and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. In addition to his best-selling memoir, Riders on the Storm, his writing has also been featured in the LA Times, Rolling Stone, The Guardian, Nation, and the Chicago Tribune, among others. Now he's at it again with his third book, titled The Seekers, Meetings with Remarkable Musicians and Other Artists. John Densmore, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ben. I wore my kick-ass tie. So, you know.
I like it, man. What is that, a bolo tie you got on there?
Yeah, for the kick-ass news.
Where'd you get that from?
My fiance gave it to me.
Oh, really?
From the Southwest.
Oh, really? You're engaged, huh?
Yeah, for the fourth time.
Fourth and final.
Hey.
Very nice. Very nice. Is she a good girl? Tell us about her.
Oh, she's the best. We've been together 10, 15 years.
Oh, no kidding.
Both had previous marriages, and now we're going to get it right.
Yeah, that's a long engagement, 10 years or so. Yeah. Finally going to put a ring on it. Good for you. Well, I really enjoyed the book, John, and I like this title, The Seekers. Do you consider yourself a seeker? And if so, what is it that you've been seeking in your life?
Huh. I kind of consider all of us seekers in a way.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeking for sort of a peace of mind, you know, especially during these tumultuous times. And, you know, I started this book several years ago because I wanted to give a tip of the hat to various musicians who fed me.
Mm-hmm.
And here it is coming out during this pandemic. And, you know, music is, it's like medicine for the soul. It's kind of healing. Yeah. And so I hope the readers can get some of that from this book.
Yeah,
and also
definitely.
Also be encouraged to do their own painting, piano playing, whatever. And you don't have to be climbing the charts. You're still going in the same zone that other that these famous artists are in. And it's a good healing salve.
So, you know, even though there's a lot of talk about creativity and kind of listening to your muse and all that, it's not just for painters and musicians and that sort of thing, huh?
Yeah, and you can do it whenever, and that's important. You know, like a meditative practice every day for find 20 minutes. And
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, I used to think of that as kooky stuff, but, you know, now all these doctors have come out telling you how important meditation is and how great it is for your mind and get your heart rate down and all this stuff.
And and we're all under this COVID cloud, which is kind of scary. And so it's good to get the heart rate down.
Yeah, definitely. Now, the first seeker in the book is actually your own mom. She was kind of a creative type. What'd you learn from her?
Well, she encouraged me to play piano, which I was grateful for, and tolerated cacophonous drums. And that was, I was grateful for that too. So she encouraged my creativity. And, you know, she lived to 94. There's a photograph of the book in the book of her painting a few days before she passed. And she said when she had pain, she painted. She channeled that pain into painting and kind of worked for her. Also, I was thinking about how in the second chapter or third, I write about Elvin Jones, John Coltrane's drummer, who was a mentor of mine. And in there, I say that that drummers and everyone else, the first drum beat you ever hear is your mom's heartbeat. You're in the womb and you hear this. And so, of course, my mom is the first chapter. I came out of her womb.
I wonder if people who don't have any rhythm, you know, maybe their mom had an irregular heartbeat or something like that.
That's funny. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that rhythm, that basic metronomic pulse is what makes everybody dance. Or, you know, if a musician doesn't have that, you can have all the technique in the world and it won't mean anything.
Yeah.
You got to have that homeland security.
How about your dad? Was he creative and supportive about your going into the music business?
Well, he was creative. He was an architect. I always thought I loved music, but I never thought I could make a living at it. And he kind of said, why don't you, you know, cut your hair and go back to college? And then I stumbled into this band called The Doors, and it's been downhill ever since.
Rest is history, yeah. I was interested to read about all the music that influenced you growing up, aside from just rock and roll. You were heavy into jazz and classical. You even talk about being moved to tears when you were a little boy by the Blue Danube Waltz and being kind of obsessed with this mad, drunken organist who played at your church. It sounds like you kind of drew inspiration from wherever you found it, huh?
Most definitely. And maybe that's what The Doors is like, because I had jazz and Ray played classical and Chicago blues, and Robbie had flamenco. So we were kind of like a melting pot. And this book kind of represents that. I have a chapter on Gustavo Dudamel, the young conductor of the LA Philharmonic, who's just masterful. And it all fed me. You know, I think I play drums sort of dynamically, like an orchestra, with fortissimo and pianissimo and everything in between. I'm not the fastest, but I think it makes it musical if you have all those emotions.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I wonder about that. Do you think that people have a tendency to equate speed with talent when it comes to drumming?
Or any instrument.
Yeah, really.
You know, you can noodle. And you know, I'm a bit older now. I was just 76. And I've come to the realization the last several years that if I put the right drum beat in the right spot, it's as powerful as when in my 20s I showed off with all my technique.
Now, a moment ago, you mentioned Elvin Jones. If anyone does know Elvin Jones, you probably heard him on some of John Coltrane's best albums. I think he's on Live at Birdland and some others. You say his drumming style is actually the one that you most emulate to this very day. What did you get from him?
His drumming was described as polyrhythmic. In other words, he had the pulse of the metronome, but he surrounded that with all kinds of little beats, and it was real complicated, but he never sacrificed the pulse. And he also had a conversation with Coltrane. You could tell they were playing off of each other.
Yeah.
And that gave me the courage to have a conversation with Jim Morrison. You know, he'd say, what have they done to the earth? What have they done to our fair sister? Stuck her with knives in the side of the jaw and dragged her down. So I'd go, I'd do what I was hearing. And then I'd go back to the beat. And I got that from Elvin and Coltrane.
And you also talk about Ray Manzarek. He was such a master of improvisation. And that's one thing that I took away from part of this book is just whether it's music or acting, improv, it absolutely requires you to be in the moment and fully present. I almost wonder if maybe you even think that improvisation is sort of another form of meditation.
Could be. I mean, being in the moment, that's the whole deal. If you're thinking too far ahead, you're not there. And if you think about the past, what's that Bob Marley line? In this great future, you can't forget your past, but dry your tears, I say, and be here now, right now, you know?
You pretty much were the rhythm section in the Doors. But Ray, was he the guy that you kind of took your cues from? Did you have to kind of keep an eye on his foot or his left hand when you guys were playing?
No, I was, you know, drummers are the heartbeat.
Sure.
But Ray's left hand was the bass. We didn't have a separate bass player.
Yeah.
And so his left hand and I were the rhythm section, bass and drums, and we hold down the pocket. And then with his right hand, he would play organ, and, you know, he split his brain into two musicians somehow and played all these great licks, like da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, Light My Fire intro, sort of Bach-like, or Riders on the Storm solo, just masterful. Yeah. Sometimes he'd get a little excited soloing, and that bass player would speed up too, and I'd have to pull him back.
Yeah,
but it was a lot of space without the bass. So,
But space is something that comes up a lot in this book. Space and the silence in music, which I don't think a lot of people actually think about. Talk a little about that.
Yeah. Well, if it was all sound, and then there'd be no contrast. I played, like, In the End, the song In the End was very quiet section. And then I played something real loud and then real quiet. It's the dynamics that make the power, you know? And I got a chapter on Ram Dass, who was a wonderful guru guy. And he had a good line, the quieter you become, the more you hear.
That's
if
true.
You listen to a Willie Nelson solo, Willie is my last chapter.
Yeah.
He's not noodling like crazy. He's leaving space in there and it makes it melodic and very, you remember it.
Yeah. I like how you talk about Willie's use of space, particularly in its phrasing. It's sort of similar to Sinatra, how he'll hold on to a lyric a little longer than most singers would feel comfortable. I mean, you really got to have confidence to pull that off, don't you?
Precisely, Ben. You said it perfectly. I have nothing to say about it. That's exactly right.
But yeah, I mean, you do have to have confidence to do that. I think a lot of singers, you know, they wouldn't feel comfortable holding on to a note the way Sinatra does and kind of letting it spill over into the next beat.
Yeah, I think I write that if you hear an artist and they sound relaxed, There's tons of work behind that to get to that place, you know.
Oh, yeah. The myth of just being a born talent and making it look easy and all that.
But no one knows the hours behind it. Once again, I encourage the reader, I hope, to get inspired to just find a little time to take a walk in nature or paint or play piano or whatever. And you know, you get in the same kind of timeless zone. You get a few minutes of infinity there when you're tripping out on your craft.
You know, Willie, he's one of those guys, he's lived a life and he's had his share of adversities, but you know, somehow he's one of these guys who always seems to keep his mellow vibe. I wonder, how does he do that? Is it the weed or what? You've spent some time with him.
It's not just the weed. He just has a loving presence like Ram Dass or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he's 87 or 8 or something.
Yeah, he's up there.
And, you know, I'm 10 years behind, but it's nice to have mentors like Paul Simon's in his late 70s, I think. Mm-hmm. Both of them are very vibrant and creative. Maybe that's a key to staying so coherent in the third act.
You know, he's almost legendary for that super potent stuff that he smokes. Did you ever sample Willie's Reserve? Is it as strong as they say?
Well, I talk about that at the beginning of my chapter with him, but I just said right away, Willie, I'm a cheap high. You can smoke for me. I had a little, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of like Jim, you know. Jim I was careful because Jim was Jim and Janice, who I also write about. Those two are cautionary tales.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just couldn't stop. But Willie's very together.
Yeah, he seems like it. You mentioned that moment in there where you compare Jim's steady descent into alcoholism with the similar path that Janis Joplin took. You know, what is it about certain artists that they almost seem predestined for that kind of end? Why is creativity and self-destruction just a package deal with some people?
Well, the important word is some. Mm-hmm. It's not with all.
Yeah.
Picasso lived to 90. With those two, you know, I mean, creative people are sensitive. And so maybe they douse their emotions to kind of, you know, Janice, she never really found a boyfriend and she was kind of lonely, even though she was worshiped by, you know, 10,000 people. You know, Jim had his soulmate, Pam, but Jim, Janice too, they became drug addicts, you know, and that'll get you. You gotta be careful. You know, I'm always asked, if Jim was around today, would he be clean and sober? And I used to say, no, kamikaze drunk. And I changed that answer the last couple of years.
Really?
No, it's a different time. There's lots of very cool people out there. And then there's Eric Clapton and Eminem. They all are clean and sober. Why not? Yeah.
A lot of the guys from that era have somehow managed to survive it and are still living well into their 70s and 80s now. So, why not? Maybe he would have. You never know.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you said about Janice being lonely, because it sounds like from the book, like there was a certain kind of loneliness to Jim as well. Despite the fact that he was in front of all these crowds and had all this adoration, there was a certain degree of isolation to that as well, huh?
Well, Jim was a deep thinker. Mm-hmm. He was questioning the universe at breakfast, you know. So he was just destined to pack it all into 27 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard. The few years after he died, I couldn't accept it. You know, I was angry with his self-destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And now, years later, I accept that he was supposed to be a shooting star. And you know, I'm on a long road, and I like that being an example for kids, you can't just wear leather pants and drink. That won't do it. So
yeah. I also find it interesting that the other three of you in the Doors didn't go down that same path as Jim. I'm sure that you drank and partied and had a good time, but you didn't let it ruin your life. Do you sort of think of watching his self-destruction as a way that kept you guys straight, maybe?
Well, yeah, it was a teaching, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. If you'll notice this sign behind me, it says Morrison Street and Densmore Avenue. Can you see that back there?
Yeah, I see that.
Right. So I grew up in L.A., and I always knew there was Densmore Street in the valley. And one day I thought, well, why don't I drive down that street just for the hell of it and see what's down there? And it crossed Morrison Street.
Weird.
These streets were named 100 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And I went, okay, we're supposed to, our destiny was set.
Yeah. Wow, that's crazy, man. I wonder, having been a witness to all this, is there a part of you that maybe was happy to be playing in the back of the band rather than being the guy in the spotlight with all that pressure and stuff and all that adoration and love that really wasn't love, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's really smart, Ben. At first, I was jealous that his picture was so big on the first album cover.
Sure.
And then after time went on, I realized that spotlight on the front guy is so bright, it's dangerous. And I just maybe got singed a little.
Yeah, and it's strange. The thing when you're always in that center spotlight, absorbing all the adoration from thousands of strangers and the ego high of it all, and then you go home. And I think there's something you talk about with both Jim and Janice. I can imagine that it has to be difficult to go from that to just, you know, being content sitting in a quiet room alone with nothing but your thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. I talk about that with Janice. She went home alone to nobody. And I think I quote a dream that Jim told me, that he dreamt that we were playing a big concert, and then he went back to the hotel room and he was walking down the hall and he heard a party in his room. And he checked the key to make sure it was the right room, and it was. And he opened the door, and a bunch of people were in there, and they looked at him like, who the hell are you? And they went on partying. That was the dream.
Wow, yeah.
Which is kind of metaphoric for all that attention, but you know, no substantive, deep friendship going on there.
Yeah, yeah, man. Talk about tapping into the subconscious there.
Yeah.
Wow. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Now, in the chapter on Jim Morrison, you refer to him as the shaman in the title of that chapter. What do you mean by that?
Shaman was not in the vernacular when we were coming up. The first time I ever heard of it, I read it in one of Jim's poems. And then I looked it up and I realized he was very well aware of so-called primitive cultures that have a medicine man, a shaman, who, you know, kind of sometimes takes peyote or whatever the hell he does, and then heals the people, goes into trance and heals. And that's, you know, that's what he was up to.
You just couldn't heal himself. Tragic.
Yeah. But the gifts, he gave us a lot of gifts.
What was your first impression of him when you first met? How did that go?
He was completely shy, had never sung before, couldn't play a chord on any instrument.
Really?
And I thought, this is not the next Mick Jagger.
Interesting.
But as the months evolved, his baritone got deeper, he got more confident, and he, you know, ultimately turned into the Lizard King. So look out.
How about Ray? You two met in, I think, Transcendental Meditation class, right? Did you even know that each other was a musician?
Well, he came up to me and he said, I heard you're a drummer. You want to jam? And I went, yeah, I always want to jam. And it was very interesting that there was no internet back then. And the Beatles across the pond were experimenting just like we were with then legal psychedelics. And then we thought, it's a little shattering on the nervous system. Let's get into this meditation thing. And we met Maharishi. And then a year later, the Beatles met Maharishi. And And then Indian music kind of seeped into both our band's songs.
Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting. Kind of a cultural undercurrent.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, in the 60s and 70s, it seems like there was a whole era where sitar was just in everything all of a sudden. No one had ever heard of sitar, and then sitar was everywhere.
Yeah, that's what we do here in America. We co-opt the thing and overdo it, you know.
I noticed that you have a chapter on Jim, you have a chapter on Ray, but you don't have a chapter on Robbie Krieger. Why is that? Is that because of the legal fights over the music or
No. I talk about Robbie's guitar playing and songwriting. I just don't have a specific chapter on him. Why is that? Let's see. Jim and Ray have broke on through to the other side. Maybe it's a tip of the hat to them because they've gone.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Although I think you say that you still talk to them. You still feel a connection to both of them, Jim and Ray, right?
I do. I mean, when Ray got sick, we had a really good healing phone call. Mm-hmm. And I quote George Harrison saying about John Lennon that if you can't have a connection with someone who was very important to you in your life, then how are you going to have a connection with Jesus, you know, or Allah or whoever?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's something to think about. So I think of them, yeah.
So even though you guys had all the legal stuff and all that, by the time he passed away, you and Ray had sort of made your peace. Y'all were cool, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was strained, but we were talking about his illness, and we didn't talk about the lawsuit. The lawsuit was over.
Yeah.
And Robbie and I played music together a few years ago, and boy, that was immediately healing.
Yeah, I'll bet.
In a minute or two, we were back, you know, because you play these songs together for a long time. They're in your blood.
I do have to ask about that whole legal battle over the commercial use of the Doors songs. I'm just curious because it's not like you guys were a bunch of monks swearing off your worldly possessions and putting all of these songs into the public domain. You sold albums, concert tickets, there was the movie and all that. Yeah, you weren't opposed to making a buck. So why did you draw the line at the commercials?
Because of Jim's reaction to the idea of "Come on, Buick, light my fire," which was a song that was primarily penned by the great Robbie Krieger. He was a wonderful songwriter.
Yeah.
That made me think, wait a minute now, Jim really cares about the whole catalog, doesn't he? You know, so we're not going to break on through to a new deodorant, you know? I got to say, you know, it's different times. If a young band needs to pay the rent and they got to do a commercial, you know, but maybe a little later, if you get successful, reexamine that decision or whatever, because I wrote an article in the Nation about this, and Tom Waits wrote a letter to the editor saying, stick to your guns, John. If you sell your lyrics to a commercial, then you've turned them into a jingle, like the sound of coins in your pocket, and you sold your audience.
Yeah.
Wow, good one, Tom. In other words, people, our music was pretty important to a soundtrack for people in Vietnam or the first time they made love or all these pivotal moments. And I'd prefer to actually... Robbie wrote Love Me Two Times because I'm going away. He meant to Vietnam. He didn't say that in the lyric, but that was the story behind the idea. So if I okayed Love Me Two Times because I just took Viagra, it's kind of changes the thing.
Yeah. 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 But I remember when all that went down with the lawsuits and all, the opposing counsel was calling you a communist or a socialist and saying you were anti-capitalist and all this stuff. You don't seem like an anti-capitalist to me. You like making a buck as much as the next guy, I assume.
Yeah. I also think when you do get the brass ring, it's good to spread it around a little bit.
I hear you.
But yeah, the word socialist is has the last few years has been thrown around like crazy. And there's an entirely difference between the socialism back in the 50s that did lead to communism and the socialism of today in, say, Scandinavian countries, where they just kind of take care of the people a little more. It's not, you know, a dictatorship or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a crazy 4 years. You think much about that? Are you into politics and that kind of thing?
Well, I'm breathing a big sigh of relief, to be blunt.
Aren't we all?
Yeah. And I don't know. We got to reach across the aisle somehow.
Yeah.
There's people in the red states that voted for Biden. So there's a little blue in there. And there's some people in the blue states that voted for Trump, though there's a little sprinkle of red in the blue. We're not that polarized. Let's come together and be the United States if we can. I think about the Leonard Cohen lyric, democracy is coming to the USA. Meaning it's not quite, we got still work to do.
I mean, well, you guys survived, you know, the Nixon era and all that. I mean, what was that like? Were you very aware of what was going on with that?
Oh, every night there was horrendous war on television.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the one thing the politicians did learn. Don't show the bodies coming back because people don't like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I had Oliver Stone on a couple of months ago, and I know that you had, I think, some involvement with the movie The Doors. What did you think about the portrayal of Jim and you guys in the film?
Val Kilmer was astounding, and he's Oliver great, made a great movie about kind of a tortured artist. I had hoped it had been more about the 60s, but then there was a documentary made that Johnny Depp narrated called When You're Strange that had a little more of the period in it. So between both of those, I'm very happy.
Yeah, it's a pretty good film for sure. I want to ask you about some of these other seekers in the book. One of the people you have in here is Ravi Shankar. So talk about slowing things down and appreciating the silence, those long form raga pieces. Yeah. I mean, they would go on for like 10, 15 minutes to the point where, you know, the repetition, everything became very meditative as well. You spent some time with him. You watched him do his thing. Did he sort of ascend into a whole other place when that guy played?
Yeah, I would call it trance music, kind of puts you in a trance. And we got the idea of stretching the end out to 10 minutes, and that had sort of raga tuning on Robbie's guitar. And Light My Fire was 6 minutes, and all these songs, the pop songs, were 3 minutes at the time. And we sort of helped break that barrier, and then... Then the Stones did Going Home, and other people did longer cuts. I think it's good to stretch out and be able to jam. You know, I mean, Riders on the Storm is long, but it's such a great ride.
Oh, yeah. Of the musicians that you've known over the years, do you think that Ravi was the one who was most at peace?
Wow, most at peace. Well, that's a challenge. I mean, I don't know if he was at peace all the time, but he had a tranquility, like Ram Dass had a tranquility. Willie has a tranquility. I don't know. At peace, but, you know, spiritual life and ordinary life are interconnected. You don't have one without the other.
Yeah.
So, you know... We all have to go to the bathroom and sometimes get divorced.
That's for sure. Now, how about Jerry Lee Lewis? You got to know him. What a cool guy. Is he a lot of fun to hang out with?
Wild.
Yeah.
Wild guy. I mean, you know, played piano with his feet and slammed the keyboard. You know, I mean, he slid his hands up and down the keys like he had bricks for fingers. I don't know how he did that. Actually, I did a audio book version of this book where I read the whole thing, and then I put music under it. I played boogie-woogie piano like Jerry Lee and classical sort of piano under my mom's stuff. And I played
played it yourself?
Myself. And played Doors drum beats under a lot of the dialogue. So that was a lot of fun.
Didn't he open for you?
Yes, he did. And this was a time we were going to play the Hollywood Bowl, and we wanted to give a tip of the hat to 50s rock and rollers whose shoulders we were on. And we asked them if we'd like to have Johnny Cash. And this was before his TV show or anything. And they said, no, he's a felon. Okay. So then 6 months later, we're at the Forum and we're big enough to dictate the second bill. So we said, we're having Jerry Lee Lewis. And the promoters said, well, nobody has heard of him and we don't care. And you know, the audience was kind of chanting Doors, Jim, Jim. But Jerry Lee rocked out, and then he stood on the piano and he said, for those of you who liked me, God love you. For the rest of you, had a heart attack. That's Jerry Lee, the killer.
As a drummer, I have to think that you probably dug how percussive his piano playing could be. Because as you said, you know, he was really banging on those keys and playing with his shoe and all that stuff.
Oh, right? he played the piano with his butt. Yeah. Talk about percussive.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's still around too now. Like, what is he, 90, 97, 95?
No. I think he's 86 or 7, something like
that. Oh, really? Oh, I thought he was in his 90s. Okay, he's still got some years on then.
Yeah. Good. Only a few years shy of 90.
Now, I should mention that not everyone in this book is a musician. You also list the great mythologist Joseph Campbell, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the poet Robert Bly, Ram Dass, of course, who you mentioned. Who among the non-musicians in this book has had the greatest influence on you?
Oh, I'm sorry, Ben. All of them you just named. You know, they're writers or poets. And poetry, well, I think that writing a sentence is a musical question.
Mm-hmm.
If it's short, it's percussive. If it's long, it's lyrical. And so I tie all that in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I write a chapter on my old acting teacher, and the phrasing in a live theatrical performance is kind of like jazz. You can change the pauses, and that's that keeps it fresh, and that's the connection with music.
Yeah, yeah, and you write poetry yourself too, right?
Nah.
No? I thought you did. Okay.
I tried and it was corny.
Yeah.
No, but I found my way into prose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wrote my first self-centered memoir. I have three now. Riders on the Storm, and it was a bestseller. I still didn't feel confident to say I was a writer. Mm-hmm. I knew I was a musician, but after a few more years of articles, I knew, okay, I really have my voice. I have another avenue of creativity here.
Yeah, yeah. Robert Bly, I mean, what a talented, interesting guy he is. Were you part of the whole men's movement? Were you into that back then?
I was, but it was so early that it was just guys getting together to talk about their feelings like women have done forever. And not just drink beer and watch sports. And we worried that it would get big and get co-opted, and it did. But it did good things. I think it inspired the Million Man March. And so, you know, I was fortunate to be in Jamaica before reggae came to the States. And I write about Bob Marley. And I saw Gustavo Dudamel guest conduct the L.A. Phil. And I knew there was magic there. And as a teenager, I saw Coltrane, and I knew there was magic. I didn't know that he was going to be an icon, but I sensed some creative thing that was unique. And
I've
been blessed to witness all this stuff.
Yeah. Were you along for the whole ride, you know, even toward the end when he got pretty out there at some point, right?
Yeah, he got kind of dissonant. I was because I knew the road. I knew he started with bebop, and then he went through Miles Davis Cool, and then Coltrane's Quartet with the beautiful version of My Favorite Things and A Love Supreme. And then he went way outer space. And you know, I went with him because there was some anger in there, you know, the civil rights thing. And I get that, certainly, you know.
Yeah.
He knew Black Lives Matter way back then, so.
Yeah, Yeah. Yeah. How about Gustavo? Sounds like you guys have kind of become pretty good friends. I mean, he really lit the whole music scene in LA on fire when he came into town.
And he's not done.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. He's the original long hair, isn't he? You guys thought that you guys were cool.
Yeah. I think I write that the 60s rockers, the Kinks and the Stones, they look like Beethoven with their hair and their ruffled shirts.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Totally. Dudamel is he's so open. Mm-hmm. Classical music has been known to be kind of rigid. And he is aware of salsa and jazz and Led Zeppelin. And if he hears something in Mahler, well, I think I titled the chapter or the subtitle is him saying to me, Juan, Mahler is heavy metal. And what he meant was that there's kind of the melody line in there that reminded him of something he heard. Mm-hmm. And he liked the connection. And he used that in conducting.
Oh, that's
amazing.
Cool.
Amazing.
Wow. Yeah, I was amazed. I don't think I ever noticed this when I've seen him perform in person, but you say in the book that he doesn't even have any notes. He doesn't have any music in front of him when he's conducting. He's just doing it by memory, huh?
Right. Except for the modern stuff.
He has
to read that. But all the Beethoven, Mahler, whatever, Mozart. Wow. I mean, he checks the manuscript backstage of the symphony he's going to conduct, and then he goes out and conducts it from memory.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's, I'd say, rather gifted, huh?
Yeah, no kidding. I wonder, before we go, what are you up to these days? Aside from the book, what are you up to? Are you just dying for COVID in so you can get back out there and perform with other people like Gustavo and all these other guys?
Well, I do miss the live. I miss people, you know. I mean, I'd be doing this in person with you. But at least we've got this, you know. And I'm promoting the book is primarily what I'm doing now, which is, quite a bit of work. A lot of signing plates that are stuck in books later. And I used to go do tours and go to bookstores and meet people, but... the paperback will be out next Christmas. Let's pray that we're better and I'll be out there.
Yeah, get out there. Can't wait to see you perform again. Well, once again, the book is called The Seekers, Meetings with Remarkable Musicians and Other Artists. John Densmore, thanks. This was great.
Great. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thanks again to John Densmore for coming on the podcast. Order The Seekers, Meetings with Remarkable Musicians and Other Artists on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow John on Twitter at John Densmore or at johndensmore.com. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.